Hi, I'm Bandhu Sujata, and welcome back to Dharma Threads for another discussion. And we're running this series of talks where we're taking the time to read through and discuss one of the great Buddhist suttas. And the particular sutta we're looking at is the Sammadhi Sutta, the Discourse on Right View. This particular discourse, Majjhima Nikaya number 9, was given by Venerable Sariputta in discussion with a group of bhikkhus. And through the discourse, he brings out various aspects of right view and looks at it from different points of view. Of course, right view is a very profound topic. It's something that rewards reflection and rewards contemplation. Each time we think that we understand something, then that's a good sign that we need to understand something more and we need to question our assumptions and look at it a bit more deeply. Let's have a look at the sutta. Last time in the last session, we discussed the upadana, grasping or clinging. And this time we're going to be looking at tanha, craving. And tanha, as was remarked in the previous session, is related to the root thirst. It actually is from the same root as the English word thirst, even though it doesn't sound very much like thirst. But actually the Sanskrit is trishna, which sounds a little bit more like thirst. But anyway, it's from the same root. Let's have a look at what the sutta says. Saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words, and they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands craving, the origin of craving, the cessation of craving, and the way leading to the cessation of craving, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is craving? What's the origin of craving? What's the cessation of craving? And what's the way leading to the cessation of craving? There are these six classes of craving. Craving for forms, craving for sounds, craving for odors, craving for flavors, craving for tangibles, craving for mind objects or Dhammas. With the arising of feeling, there is the arising of craving. With the cessation of feeling, there's the cessation of craving. The way leading to the cessation of craving is just this noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood craving, the origin of craving, the ending of craving, and the way leading to the cessation of craving, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so for this section, we're looking at what is regarded as the root cause, or one of the ways of expressing the root cause for suffering and for samsara, and that is craving. And we talked about in the last time how craving is a more primal thing compared to upadana. Upadana, or grasping, is somewhat more developed, somewhat more sophisticated, somewhat more intellectual, if you like. But the craving is like a sort of a brute emotional response to things. Here it's expressed in terms of the six kinds of craving. Craving for forms, that's things you see. Craving for sounds, things you hear. For odors, flavors, tangibles, that means things that you touch with your body. And craving for mind objects is dhammas. Now the craving for mind objects or dhammas is something which can be very broad, right? So it includes imaginations, visual imagery, memory, emotions, thoughts, ideas, concepts, and so on and so forth. So actually within that, it can include the kinds of intellectual constructs which we were talking about with upadana, right? So it's not as if these things are completely different, but it's more a matter of emphasis, yeah? Those mind objects, the dhammas, of course, this is the most interesting form of craving in a way. The sense objects are fairly straightforward, fairly simple, but the craving for dhammas is quite complex. The first thing to understand about the craving for dhammas is that ultimately all of those dhammas that we experience are derived in some way from that physical experience, right? It's conditioned by our growth of our mind is always conditioned by and in that environment, in that context of physical experience. And it's from, if you look at the way, for example, that we use metaphors, you use language, right? We're always using language to give a concrete imagery to more abstract things, such as, for example, I use the word concrete, yeah? And we have these metaphors that are embodied in our language all the time, and that way we move from those sense objects, right, the things we're experiencing, the physical things, towards the ideas that we're experiencing in our mind. So as well as expressing the craving in terms of the craving for the six senses, the craving is also expressed in the Four Noble Truths and other contexts in terms of the threefold craving. It's karma tamha, sensual craving, bhava tamha, craving to be, right? Craving for we talked earlier about bhava existence, right? And then vibhava tamha, craving for non-existence, right? Or craving for annihilation or nihilism. And as far as I'm aware, the Buddha was the first great philosopher or spiritual teacher to acknowledge the importance of this vibhava tanha, this negative craving. I mean, the craving for, you know, sense experience, the craving to live, these are things which are fairly obvious, right? The idea that we crave to not be, right, is much more subtle. Of course, is similar or related to the in Western psychology, Freud had his, like, death wish and thanatos, which also is this recognition that, you know, underneath the obvious, right, craving to be, craving to have, craving to experience, there's also a shadow side of that, which is a craving to get rid of, a craving to not be, a craving to die. Yeah, somehow all of those kinds of things are peaceful. Right, it's much less challenging. Yeah, and much less hard work. You know, it's sometimes easy to think, oh, it would be nice if we could just not be. Yeah? Being is work. Being is not something that's just given to you. Being something you have to respond to constantly, yeah? And that's a lot of work. So there's this underlying desire for a vibhava tanha, and by placing that there and then recognizing that, we're also recognizing or at least making it possible to start distinguishing and identifying the role that vibhava tanha, that craving for annihilation, the role that plays in spiritual practice as well. Right? Because a lot of the times in our spiritual practice, we're actually coming from that sense of negativity and rejection, actually wanting to not be, to not have, to get rid of. Yeah? And it's not easy to distinguish that from the genuine sense of letting go, which comes from the Dhamma. Yeah? Not easy at all. But at least we have if we understand that they are two separate things, we can begin to inquire, begin to discern, and to learn what the difference is between those two things. So with craving, it's just those animal instincts. It's just that wanting to have, wanting to get rid of. And it's those things which drive our life and drive our sense of being at this very, very basic level. And one of the things that I always think when you look at biology and you look at the account of evolution and how life comes to be and so on, it always seems to me that I mean, maybe I just don't understand the science well enough, but it always seems to me that it's somehow it's an assumption. See, this craving to be and to have and so on, it seems like evolution and life needs that positive force, right? Selection is what winnows you out and enables you to achieve that thing that you want to achieve. But it seems like the unquestioned, unspoken assumption behind that is that there's a wanting to be, there's that craving to be. But that somehow gets missed out, I think, for some reason. So that force, that life force, that will to be, that will to live, that will to have, yeah? We don't question it. Right? We don't reflect on it. It's so inherent in everything that happens, every moment of our lives and so on, that to actually step back and say, what would it be like if we didn't want to experience? We didn't want to have this or that. We didn't want to know this or know that. We didn't want to not have any of those kinds of things. What if we just didn't have those cravings at all? What would happen then? You know, all of the psychological studies on craving and and reward all show, you know, that you reach a saturation point with your cravings very quickly, actually. It doesn't take long at all, right? And so we're constantly having to shift them and to recover from them and to try to negotiate them and work our way around so that you can still get what you want without actually hitting that saturation point. But the reality is that it's there. And the reality is that if you look at the more powerful or more extreme forms of craving, like, say, drug addiction, where, you know, you have an extremely powerful hit very, very quickly, right? It's giving you huge amounts of pleasure very, very fast, right? Now, one of the things, you know, this kind of discussion about drugs and drug abuse and legalization and things like that, and one of the things which you almost never find actually talked about in that conversation, and I honestly can't remember it being talked about in a single time. I did some research on this a couple of years ago. I couldn't see a single time when they actually talked about the pleasure of drug use, right? Which is, of course, why people use, and people are like, oh, they're addicts, or they're ill, and so on, they haven't got things. Actually, the reason people take drugs is because they find it to be intensely enjoyable, and they find it to be so pleasurable that it's worth more than everything else in their life, right? Ultimately, including their relationships and their job and everything like that. If it gets to that extent, obviously, it usually doesn't. But if you leave pleasure out of the equation, right? You are completely misunderstanding the nature of what's going on, and you're putting that into a kind of separate area, as if you're saying people who seek pleasure, even if it's harmful, are mentally ill and are a social problem that needs to be put in jail and controlled with legislation. Whereas in fact, all of us seek pleasure in ways that's harmful to us and harmful to others. All right, maybe not to such an extreme extent, but the principle is the same. Yeah? So, you know, drug addiction is nothing mysterious. It's just the same thing that we all do, taken to an extreme degree. Yeah? And similar with other kinds of addiction and so on. So that craving always is like that. I remember hearing a radio interview many years ago, and it was this author who'd previously been a crack addict, and he'd been like homeless and a very bad addict and so on for many years, and he was talking about his life story and so on. He'd written a book about it, and he began up saying, you know, how it all began. Somebody gave him some crack and he had it. It was the most amazing thing that he experienced in his life, yeah? And as soon as it was over, he was like, where can I get some more? And every time he tried it, it was never quite like it was the first time, and that whole search was to experience what it was like that first time, and it was never quite as good. And that precisely is the difference between the pleasure that you get from pursuing those kinds of pleasures and the pleasure you get from spiritual practice and pleasure from Dhamma practice, because pleasure from Dhamma practice has no diminishing marginal utility, to use the economics phrase, yeah? It has an increasing marginal utility. It keeps on getting better and better every time you do it. It doesn't lose that freshness because it's not a kind of pleasure which diminishes and harms your consciousness. Why is that? Why is it that these kinds of pleasures can't be recaptured, and why they get worse all the time, right? It's because they're actually damaging your consciousness. They make your mind worse, and because your mind is worse, it can't experience in the same way. Yeah? Whereas with Dhamma practice, it's actually making your mind better. It's making your mind clearer, your consciousness brighter. So every time you experience it, every time you have a good meditation, it's just as fresh or even fresher or even better the more you go into it. We're looking at the contemplation of feeling, or the role of feeling in dependent origination. So let's read through the sutta passage and then we have some discussion. Saying, good friend, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words, then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in this noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands feeling, the origin of feeling, the cessation of feeling, and the way leading to the cessation of feeling, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is feeling? What is the origin of feeling? What is the cessation of feeling? And what is the way leading to the cessation of feeling? There are these six classes of feeling. Feeling born of eye contact, feeling born of ear contact, feeling born of nose contact, feeling born of tongue contact, feeling born of body contact, feeling born of mind contact. With the arising of contact, there is the arising of feeling. With the cessation of contact, there is the cessation of feeling. The way leading to the cessation of feeling is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. When a noble disciple has thus understood feeling, the origin of feeling, the cessation of feeling, and the way leading to the cessation of feeling, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust, he abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion, he extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am, and by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. When we're talking about feeling here, we have to be very clear to understand what it is that feeling is and what it isn't. Feeling in Buddhism is, or Vedana in Buddhism, is purely, it's a very simple thing. It's a very primary aspect of experience, okay? And it's the pleasant, painful, or neutral aspect of experience, right? So it's the most basic level of colouring of our experience, right? Is it something that's pleasant that draws us in? Is it aversive? Is it pushing us away? Or is it neutral? Something that we're not that interested in, not paying attention to. Yeah? These three different aspects. Yeah? I know that in some usage in modern times in Buddhism, that it comes to have different kind of meanings. I think, if I'm not mistaken, in Sri Lankan, Vedana means something like sadness or depression or something like that. Or emotion, I think in Thai it's used in the sense of kind of emotion or something like that. So it comes to have different meanings in different contexts. Also, when we use the word feeling in an English context, feeling is quite a complex thing, right? So feelings and emotions are complex and quite sophisticated phenomena, which have a cognitive element, and they have a behavioural element, and they have a biological element, and all of these kinds of things. So it's important to remember that when we're talking about feeling as such, that we're just coming back to that simplest aspect. Now, of course, those feelings, the pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings of things, relates to and influences and is connected with those more complex emotions that we also feel, right? So it's not that they're completely separate from them, right? So we can recognize that we have different kinds of emotions, but we recognize the emotion, for example, of, say, depression, right? And the emotion of, say, grief, right? Might be different emotions, but they're both on that side of being dukkha. They're both dukkha vedana, but there's a certain difference in the tone of them that we can recognize. And similarly, you know, the notion of, say, contentment, right? And the emotion of joy, somewhat different kinds of feelings, right? But they're both pleasant feelings. They're both sukha vedana, even though they're different kinds of sukha vedana. So the vedana itself is, are we drawn to something or are we repelled by it? And so the idea is that this vedana is the fundamental thing which is orientating and driving our awareness, right? And our attention, right? Our attention is always going towards the pleasant, away from the unpleasant, towards the pleasant, away from the unpleasant. And that's stimulating our craving, yeah? So our craving is, and then all of the other factors of dependent origination, yeah? So you see something that's pleasant and you want more of it. See something that's unpleasant, you want to get rid of it. So there's this constant movement which is being propelled by these different kinds of feelings, right? However, the link between feeling and craving is not a necessary one. It's a link of association and tendency, but it's not absolute, right? We have some control how we respond to it. And we can all feel that, right? You all know the experience of, yes, you see something pleasant, you see an ice cream, you think, oh, I'm going to go out the ice cream, and then you think, no, hang on, I won't, right? So you can choose how you're going to respond to it. Similarly with the aversive responses, right? Maybe you get really annoyed at someone. You're going to yell at them and then you think, oh, no, I won't. Yeah, you kind of restrain yourself. So we do have some choice about how we respond to feeling. But usually we don't necessarily exercise that choice, right? We're to a large extent, we're just driven so automatically by these feelings, response, stimulus, response. And to a large extent, our whole life is nothing but, right? A sort of sequence of this, of going from one pleasant feeling to the next pleasant feeling, enduring painful feelings because you think it'll get you some pleasant feelings in the future, right? That's why you go to work, right? You go there and you think, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to endure these unpleasant sensations and things for the next 8 hours because after that I can do what I want, yeah? And so our lives are constantly negotiating back and forth with these pleasant and painful feelings. And we're trapped by them, right? We think that freedom means that we can get the things that we want and enjoy the pleasures that we want. And in fact, the more we chase those things, the more that we're actually being trapped by that and trapped by that hunt for pleasure. In Buddhism, the structure of experience is that we have these primary sense data, right? Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, all of which are quite distinct, right? They're quite distinct kinds of things, and all of which are quite particular, right? There's quite different kinds of knowledge that you can derive from each sense, right? But those senses remain as they are. They remain sort of bound to that particular sense object, right? So we don't see people and dogs and chairs and tables. We see colour, right? So essentially that's what rupa is. We see light. Colour is just different wavelengths of light. Brightness is just different amplitudes of light. And so that's basically what we're seeing, is you see light. Similarly, and that light ultimately is vibrations, right? Yeah, electromagnetic vibrations. Similarly with sound, what you're hearing is basically vibrations. It's variations in air pressure. Yeah, is what you're hearing. And that's all that the object of sound is variations in air pressure, and so on for the different senses. So it's our mind that does all the other work, right? So our mind is infinitely more complex than any of those things. I mean, put it into context, we can make machines like cameras and microphones and so on, which can mimic the other senses reasonably well. Maybe not completely, but at least do a reasonable job of mimicking those things. But we're a long, long way of even starting to understand what it might be like to make a machine that would mimic the mind. Yeah? So the first thing that the mind does is to take this sense data and process it and try to make sense out of it. Right, recognize that sights are different from sounds. They're different kinds of things, right? So every stage in this can break down, right? So you know you have synesthesia and things like that where you mistake sights and sounds, right? So something's going on with your mind consciousness that the wires are crossed. But as well as knowing that these things are separate things, you also know that they're related things. Right? So, you know, you can imagine from an infant and developing that you learn, oh, you know, I can hear the sound, this particular sound, and I can see that particular shape, and then you realize, oh, that's the sound of my mother's voice, right? That this sound is associated with this particular shape, and I only see them together, right? And then you can imagine the whole learning process that would go through, the mother talking to the baby and there's association, but then maybe the mother's in the other room and talking so the baby can hear the sound but without... So it's actually quite a learning process to learn how to put these things together. But that's one of the basic things that the mind consciousness does. But the mind consciousness then builds up the world in more and more sophisticated ways by developing these models of the world, models of the past and the future, for example. Models of the past we call memory, models of the future we call plans and expectations, right? And developing various theories, views, ideas, beliefs, emotions, character traits, behaviours, and so on and so forth. And so all of these things are part of what we call mind consciousness. So these are ways in which we come to know the world, right? So you know the world through mind consciousness, just as we know the world through sense consciousness, right? But the knowing through mind consciousness is always, at some point, derived from our knowing on sense consciousness. I suspect, and this is not something I've done the research I can prove, but I suspect that that attitude, because you don't find that attitude traditionally in Buddhism at all, right? If you look certainly in the suttas, you don't find it. If you look in the commentaries, Visuddhimagga and things like that, you don't find those attitudes, right? Visuddhimagga says, you know, quite explicitly that in order to get the three kinds of concentration, Kanika Samadhi, Upachara Samadhi, Apanna Samadhi, is Kanika is momentary threshold and absorption concentration, Samadhi, they all are based on sukha. They're all based on pleasant feeling. And that's straight in line with what the suttas are saying, huh? And yet this attitude is very strong in meditation circles that arose in the 20th century, that you sort of have to avoid sukha and that only equanimity is good. And I can't help thinking that seems to me to be a reaction or derived from a kind of Western ideas, Western psychology, a kind of early Western psychology, not kind of modern psychology, but early psychology. I think there was a fear of pleasure. An association of sort of a, again, ultimately derived from a Christian point of view, perhaps, a sort of guilt feeling around pleasure, the idea that spiritual practice and good things hurt, right? And you had to go, and so if you look in sort of like sort of Freudian psychology and things like this, there's always a kind of a exaltation of the role of pain and suffering, alienation and things. These are the things that really define a personality, and that growth comes through admitting your pain and acknowledging them and so on. And I kind of had the feeling that there's this kind of sense from the Western psychology, again I'm talking late 19th, early 20th century, of an aversion to emotions and that kind of emotionality and pleasure. And I suspect that infected the Buddhist world at the time, which was then forming what we call modernist Buddhism, forming ways of expressing the Dhamma, which was going to be relevant and meaningful in a then modern idiom, right? And of course, that was around the time that, say, Freud wrote his The Future of an Illusion, where he talked about samadhi as being, or meditation as being, like a withdrawal to the womb, right? This kind of thing that you're kind of longing for, this infantile regression kind of state, which I don't have a problem with Freud saying that, right? Because Freud didn't know anything about meditation. He didn't have any experience of it. So, of course, he made some mistakes. So I don't particularly think that's a big deal. But it is a big deal when it influences, in the Buddhist world, people who should know better. And when you still find those ideas being repeated today by meditation teachers who should know better. And so I kind of suspect that this whole kind of anti-pleasure movement in Buddhist meditation was a kind of implicit reaction to that, to say, oh no, our meditation isn't about an infantile regression to the womb, it's not about absorption in pleasant feeling, it's not about all this emotional stuff, but it's about understanding reality. It's rational and it's clear mind and it's based on equanimity and it's scientific. Yeah? Buddhist traditions up to that time, right? Now we're now thinking late 19th century Buddhist traditions were probably very devotionally based, right? Mostly. They're not based on actually understanding Dhamma and things like that. They're based on devotion to an idea of the Buddha, and there's a lot of emotional commitment and joy, and all of those emotional qualities often would have been there, but that's all there would have been, right? So I can understand that you'd then make a movement to say, no, hang on, we've got to bring in this wisdom side, we've got to bring in this clear side, we've got to bring in this equanimity side, right? So I can see as a balancing aspect that there's actually probably quite a good idea, right? But it's just that when that gets taken out of context, it then becomes something which is, I think can be quite damaging. And I think that kind of fear of pleasure is something which has been damaging in Buddhist meditation. Fortunately, it seems to be fading away in Buddhism and in modern psychology. I think that largely because of the Buddhist influence, actually, they've both been moving in that direction the last, say, 20, 30 years or so, much more positive role to the role of pleasure in spiritual practice and personal development. There's a wonderful book written by a feminist psychologist, Carol Gilligan, a number of years ago called The Birth of Pleasure. One of the bhikkhunis, Ayatimutta, pointed that book out to me, and that was a very beautiful book. And she was like consciously replacing this kind of Freudian narrative, which says that our personality and our development is shaped by trauma and division and suffering, and saying, no, actually, it's shaped by love and connection and relationship and happiness, and the experience of pleasure is actually the primary thing which is building healthy people. And obviously, that's not to deny the role of suffering and so on. Obviously, that has a role. But those main formative and developmental processes in ordinary psychology are based on pleasure, as they are in our spiritual practice and our Dhamma practice. So yeah, we're going to experience pain and we're going to sit and it's going to be uncomfortable and all kinds of things will happen. But the pleasure is what leads us to deeper and deeper states of peace and deeper and deeper states of clarity. So I think that's probably all we have time for now in this particular discussion. So thank you very much once more to all of our panelists for your contributions, all very valuable, and a great discussion of pleasure. So we will, and other feelings. So that's all from Dhamma Threads for now. We'll look forward to seeing you again next time.